during this review, I've tried to pinpoint that maybe it means that we need to review the notion of reference frame when talking about DSR. And I will ask the question that maybe this revision of the notion of reference frame should be due to the fact that in quantum gravity, we need to deal with quantum reference frames. And so I will tell you, I will give you some arguments why in quantum gravity we need to talk about quantum reference frame. And then I will deal with a toy model where I can explicitly construct this quantum reference frame. And I will study it, and we'll see what will happen. OK, so first, the motivation. So this conference is mainly on experimental search for quantum gravity signals. So I'm not going to review the different experiments that that people are looking at. But for sure, I mean, what we want to do is to also construct some to make some predictions for those experiments coming up. Okay. So if you are very conservative, what you want to take is take this partition function, which contains gravitational degrees of freedom and the matter degrees of freedom, and basically try to take a semi-classical state, if you're able to construct, for example, a flat semi-classical space-time. Okay, you put it in there, and then you obtain the effective Lagrangian for matter. And in those experiments, people should basically look at this kind of things, right? They should see effect induced by this modified Lagrangian, effective Lagrangian. So of course, it's difficult to do, and so you have to follow to use some techniques. For example, you can use spin forms, all right? Or so that was a conservative point of view, but if you are more liberal, I would say, you can add extra dimensions. I mean, modify this partition function, add strings, d particles, like Nick. I mean, so you can do a lot of things. So personally, I'm for that, I would be more conservative. This is not my political point of view. Eh? So I take this partition function. I would take this partition function and look at it. And so if we deal with a 2 plus 1 space-time, like a 3D space-time, then because gravity in this case is pretty simple, this partition function can be very, analyzed pretty well. And Etera and Laurent basically gave a nice description of that. And they showed that what you obtain is really deformed special relativity. Okay, so in a 4D case, we cannot do that, obviously. So basically, what my perspective, that I think that is shared by many, is that we need to construct the theory by hand. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to try to input by hand in an effective theory those quantum gravity fluctuations around flat space time. So we're going to take flat space time, I mean special relativity, and for example, try to implement a Planck scale in the game. So clearly, special relativity defined in terms of Poincaré symmetries. And if I have a scale, a new scale, a new fundamental scale, it means that something needs to happen to those symmetries. So maybe the first thing is that, in fact, nothing happens, right? So that would be the case, for example, for causal set, where you have really some discrete space. But then they show that there is still this Lorentz symmetry in the game. The Snyder space, which is a non-commutative space, also has a discrete there's a minimum length, Planck scale, but still it's consistent with the Lorentz symmetry. The second possibility, of course, is that the symmetry is broken, okay? And I think tomorrow Stefano will give a very exciting talk, at least. This for me, basically, so I refer to this talk for tomorrow. And then the third possibility that I like to explore is that we deform the symmetries. Okay, so we modify, we twist the symmetry such that they are still consistent with this new scale that we put in the game. Okay, so there is still a relativity principle. And clearly, if we want to be able to distinguish between these different cases, we need either a full derivation from the fundamental theory, or basically experiments will tell us that one is wrong. And clearly, it means that in each of the cases, we need to make some predictions for the experiments. In particular, it means that we need to understand well the physics, which, for the deformed case, is not the case. I would say that so we don't really understand yet the physics. So let me concentrate on DSR case, this deformed special relativity. So like Franz reviewed before, you can see this DSR case where you implement really a non-linear realization of the Lorentz group. So that was the picture that Lee and Zhou implemented. So there is this platonic momentum, pi. At this time, I'm not going to say what is physical meaning. So this will come later. And then there is the platonic pi, and then there is a physical p. And p is a nonlinear function of pi, such that basically this guy is bounded by the Planck scale. And if you want to have a Lorentz transformation that is consistent with this universal scale, what you do is that you you want to transform this guy, and you use this nonlinear map to go to pi. You do your Lorentz transformation, and you transform it back. So when you transform it back with f, you're sure that you implemented this bound again, this Planck mass again. Okay, and then we get this modified dispersion relation with the physical quantities. Then what you need to do, so this was for momentum, and you need to construct a space-time, and you need to glue space-time with momentum space such that this is consistent with those deformed symmetry I talked about 2 seconds ago. Okay, there are a couple of ways to do, and of course then, so you can do that for one particle, but clearly you have to do, you have also to discuss how you can put many particles together. Okay, and it's important to realize that you have to be careful. If you are careful enough, you're not doing just special relativity in a free choice of coordinates. It's not that you're just, for example, doing special relativity in polar coordinates where things would become very ugly. So here, if you choose carefully the structure that I defined before, then you're really doing some new physics. And so there is this bicross product basis example, which I would think is the best, most well-defined theory at the mathematical level. So at the mathematical level, this theory was derived from a geometric point of view or from an algebraic point of view. So mathematically, I think this is pretty sound. And so in this case, the platonic momentum lives in a 5D space. And this is because what we do, you can have a geometric interpretation, is that we curve momentum space. So since the momentum space, the 4D momentum space is curved, it means that you can embed it in a higher dimensional space. So this higher dimensional space is this platonic space. So you got this f, you remember this nonlinear function is introduced here. And so it's going to transform nonlinearly. And then we got this modified dispersion relation, which is pretty complicated. We get also a non-commutative space-time. So it's really time that is non-commutative, non-commuting with space. And we get a modification of the Poisson bracket structure. And also, you get the modification of the momentum addition. So clearly, it's just the vector part of the 3D momentum which is modified. And you can notice that it's really non-trivial because the first particle has some input from the second particle. Okay, so this means that this addition is non-commutative. So this is very well defined on a mathematical level, like I was saying. And yes.
It's not symmetric then.
Yeah, that's what I said. So it's not symmetric, so it's non-commutative. You need to put some label. All right. So since it's very well defined, what you can do, you can go on and construct a field theory on this space. So Michele is doing that. You can go on. But then, for me, there will be a number of physical questions that can be asked, like some questions where. Some questions were asked this morning in the previous talk, but so maybe so these questions are not by order of importance. They are just I wrote them and they came to my mind. So clearly that if we start to have a non-commutative sum of momenta, then it means that we need to put label. This is not something we are used to do in visual quantum field theory. So why would there be this labeling thing? I mean, what physically does it mean? And then there is this so-called Ball problem, which is that if we put a bound on this 3D on the 3D momentum, for example, then when we define the sum like I defined it before, then the sum is going to be still bounded by the Planck mass, which means that it's hard to get some macroscopic object which have a mass or momentum bigger than the Planck mass, which is pretty annoying. But I think like a soccer ball has already above the, if you shoot or kick a soccer ball, then it's going to have a momentum bigger than that. Yeah, I shouldn't do it. So that's a problem. So people came up with some suggestion for solution, like Joao came up with one. Etera and I also had some proposal. And then there is also like Daniel's question this morning: what is the meaning of this pi here? And you can come up certainly with many other questions in, that you have in mind. Okay. So we need to try, I mean, my goal would be to try to make some, to give some physical meaning to that. And so for that, I should, so it means that, so there was this construction on a mathematical level, maybe we should take another angle of attack to try to understand this structure. And this other angle of attack would be to remember that if we have symmetries, symmetries relate reference frames. Okay, so it means that if we change symmetries, it means that we modifying the notion of reference frame. So let's do that. Let's try to incorporate this structure in this notion of modified reference frame. So I introduce a reference frame, so it's tetrad here. So this is just this guy. This is a alpha labels a bunch of vectors, and mu basically is the coordinate of those vectors in a 4D space-time. Okay, so that's just the tetrad. Then I have the momentum of my particle, which is pi. And then if I want to look at the value of this momentum in the reference frame, what I do is just I project the momentum on the reference frame. Okay? So basically, now you see that from the slides I had before, I kind of start to have a physical meaning of the pi and the p. Okay? So the pi is an intrinsic quantity, the momentum to associated to the particle, and the p, the physical momentum, is the coordinate of this pi in a given reference frame. All right? So here's flat space normal stuff.
So the reference frame is just
it's a bunch of vectors. It's a bunch of vectors. I define a bunch of vectors. So here are my three vectors. I have another vector for time. Yeah. That's my
okay. If you take the original coordinates, the reference frame is just a Lorentz transformation, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like you have a patch that's rotated in some way in flat space.
It's just like. It's just a standard reference frame. It's a bunch of vectors. Then you can relate. Okay, now you can relate different reference frames by using a Lorentz transformation. Yes.
Yeah, but I think your point is more that the description of a measurement requires the notion of the frame, which is the plots and the rulers, and therefore what the measurement reports is the p index in terms of the plots and rulers. And now you're going to do some funny business with the Portuguese, which are the plots and the rulers.
Yes, exactly. So now if I change, if I use a different reference frame, move on, sorry, of course, there's another one which is over there, for example, which is related by Lorentz transformation, then clearly this induces a Lorentz transformation on the coordinate. Okay, and here this is just, so it means that my coordinates, here the physical coordinates here, are just transformed under a linear representation of the Lorentz group. Okay? This perspective was put forward by Stefano, Matt, and Sebastiano Sonico. All right? And so what they said is that maybe if you have a deformation of a symmetry, then it means that we should deal with a modified reference frame. So we should modify the notion of reference frame to incorporate this idea of a deformation of a symmetry. So now I'm going to get an effective reference frame, which is going to depend on my original reference frame and my system there. So there is a non-trivial, the effective reference frame depends on the particle here. So as an example, we can take this guy. So this guy will generate something like the Maggio-Smolin dispersion relation. All right? So this is my effective reference frame here. And now clearly, if I want to do a Lorentz transformation, so it means that I need to pick up another, so I have my effective reference frame. The fundamental variable that I have is my E, so this is my reference frame, this guy. So if I want to do a Lorentz transformation, what I need to do is that I need to undeform my reference frame, do my Lorentz transformation, and then transform it back. Okay, so.
So am I to understand that I cannot measure in this reference frame two particles with widely different momenta?
So two particle case is coming up. Wait a bit. Okay. So I get this funny reference frame, this funny effective reference frame, which is depending on momentum, and there is actually a mathematical meaning of having such structure. And this guy is basically encode the fact that we are dealing with a thin metric and not with a Riemannian metric anymore. Yes.
So if you want to tell the story about this, you'd say something like the fact that there's particles in the neighborhood of the reference frame with the momentum pi means that there's some back reaction and
exactly.
It's also the properties of the
exactly.
Is there an H bar somewhere in, is that a quantum effect or I mean, there is an
A-bar and M-bar. Yeah, there is an A-bar and M-bar. So here, this is an effective approach. Huh? I mean, now what we need to do, so that's the proposal, so that was a proposal, and we need to provide some justification of why it could be the case. And in this case, see, you need to check, according to your model, how you construct this effective frame, if you have H-bar or not. So Stefano and his collaborators from Gran Sasso worked out that provided a number of few arguments. I'm going to cross-grain all those arguments in three lines, and so it's a very cross-grain, and so I encourage you to read the papers. So basically his point is that if I have a particle that goes in this fluctuating space-time, then the particle is going to probe space-time up to its wavelength. Okay? And so basically it means that it's going to see an average momentum up to this k. Okay? And so since L now is a function, I can relate L to the energy of the particle, that means that I'm going to get an effective momentum, the average momentum, depending on the energy of the particle. Okay, so this is a very coarse-grained argument. I encourage you to read the papers to have a much better, I mean, a finer details. I should say that we have also obtained something like that. So the metric is momentum dependent. In the context of normalization group equation, where we have, in a normalization group applied to gravity, we obtain a metric that depends on the scale. And if you're dealing with just one particle in space-time, it's natural to identify the scale with the probing object, which is the particle. Okay, so you can relate the scale with the momentum of the particle. All right, and then to answer your question, in this case, it's not clear how to extend that for many particles. Okay. It's going to depend on how you construct your effective reference frame, okay? but the key so that's one question to answer. So in this formalism, it's not clear how to extend to the multiparticle case, but the most fundamental question is that we need to provide really a concrete mechanism that makes the reference frame particle dependent. Yes.
I have a rather stupid question of understanding. What actually do you mean with particle? I mean, is it...
It's a classical particle.
It's a counterpoint.
Yeah. So it's usually it's like a particle, so just a normal particle, but then here we say it's quantum. I mean, there are a lot of approximations.
So your modifications of the reference frame, they should, like, vanish in the asymptotic distance, things like that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, in this case, if it's scale dependent, yes, you should, if you cross-grain very much, then you don't see any effect, should go away.
Yeah, so this stochastic fluctuation of your reference frame, like, should lead to some violation of microcausality, locality, maybe? Like, even the fact that the distances, I mean, if the reference frame has some stochastic fluctuation, like, defining...
I don't know, yeah, okay, so...
Very well. Yeah, but they have a typical scale, first of all, which is the Planck scale. This is how you get...
Sure, but I mean... But
in principle, you can get a stochastic fluctuation of the metric. If you can probe it at the Planck scale, of course you can have even... I don't know exactly what you have in mind, but of course the light...
But I mind just a violation of locality, like the way you mean it in the standard...
We're not looking at that, but I would guess that there's...
Light from fluctuations don't violate causality.
No, but it's not like fluctuation does, no?
Yeah, but I don't know whether you want. By the way, sorry, you just need like some fluctuating space like distance.
All right.
But not necessary. Yeah. If you do it properly.
All right.
Perhaps you can have the discussions, long discussions after.
Yes, so you remember, so I have this, so Stefano and Martin Follner proposed this modified reference frame stuff. And now we saw, coming back a bit to my effective approach earlier, we saw that to construct this effective, to construct in an effective way a flat semi-classical space-time as a choice, the symmetry was broken, untouched, or deformed. And in this case, you can see that it means that you're doing obviously something with the reference frame. So here you introduce the preferred. If it's broken, you have a preferred reference frame. If it's untouched, things are a bit fuzzy, I would say here, because I'm not sure how a frame would be defined, but since the symmetries are untouched, I assume that that would be a way to define a frame in the usual way. And if the symmetry is deformed, then we get a modified frame. So the question now is, can we argue from the quantum gravity perspective if there is one of those possibilities that is preferred? Okay? That would be cool. And so in quantum gravity, what we need to talk is a quantum reference frame. So now what I'm going to talk about is to explain you why in quantum gravity we need to talk about quantum reference frame. And then I will study this quantum reference frame in a toy model to see which one of those is preferred. So, suspense. All right. So why quantum reference frame? So quantum gravity, or gravity first at the classical level, gravity is a constraint theory. So we have the diffeomorphic symmetries, which are encoded in constraints, first-class constraints. And if we look at observables, so observables are functions on phase space. And so they are observable, changing color. So observables are functions on phase space, and functions on phase space that commute with the constraints. And clearly, in the GR case, it is pretty difficult to construct those. But then Carlo Rovelli like promoted, I guess many others before, but Carlo I think was the most clear about that, promoted this idea that if we introduce a physical reference frame, then we can construct really observables. And then Bianca made all this formalism in a very general way. So now I think you can construct a large set of observables using the notion of reference frame. And there's also this last paper by Giddings, Arthur Marov, which is pretty cool on this topic. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the GR case because it would take too long, that would be too complicated. Just let me illustrate the situation. So I'm going to take two examples where I have a constraint, where I have constraints. I'm going to construct observables. So the first case is pretty simple. It's a relativistic particle. Okay, so that's this action. I can do the analysis. I have no Hamiltonian. Okay, the Hamiltonian is zero. And so if I do the Lagrangian transform, I go from the Lagrangian formalism to the Hamiltonian formalism. And so since I have a Hamiltonian to be zero, I have time or parameterization invariance, which is encoded in this constraint. Okay, the Machiel there encodes the fact that I have this time of parameterization invariance. All right? So this is my constraint. And now I can construct observables. So to construct observables, I need a function of phase space that commute with this Machiel. Okay? And clearly, since this Machiel is just the Poincaré-Casimir, the Lorentz transformation and translation do commute with that. Okay, so they are observables. But then if I look at X, X is not commuting. So, it means that the position is not an observable. So to introduce an observable position, we need to go to a relational picture. So this is my new function of phase space. Okay, and you can check that this function of phase space actually does commute with the Machiel. Okay, and you can, so if you see that if you look at the 3D part of this guy, 3D part is just pi divided by p0, so it's just vi. So what this guy is, in fact, if you let t varying, is just that you're considering the full trajectory, okay? And what I'm doing here is I'm introducing a clock x0 such that when x0 indicates t, what my position is just x mu. Okay, so from this perspective, this is rational. It is rational. So when x0 indicates t, I am at x. I could have chosen different kind of clocks, obviously. So for example, the another clock could have been the dilatation, all right? And so this guy is a new observable, so it's a different way to parameterize my trajectory. And so this guy commutes with my shell, and in this case, I get non-commutative coordinates. And here, I didn't write it, but here, if you look at the commutation relation between the x mu, you get just a standard, this is a commuting space. All right, so that's one example. So the moral of the thing is that if you have first class constraints, you want to construct observables, you can introduce a frame, so here was a clock, and then look at the degrees of some degrees of freedom in terms of this clock, and then this is an observable. Okay, so you need to have a rational view. It's useful to have a rational point of view to construct observables when you have symmetries. Okay, another example which is more maybe easier to visualize is that I'm considering a bunch of spins. They are classical spins for now, and so I have mini spins around there, and I impose the constraints that this total cloud of spins is invariant under rotations. Okay, so it means that the total spin of this set of spins is just zero. So it means that I have those constraints that encode the fact that so the total spin is zero. Okay, and now I want to. So this is my set of constraints that encode the SU2 symmetry, global symmetry. And now I want to construct observables. So what can I do? So if I pick up just one axis, just one spin, this is clearly not an observable since one spin indicates the preferred direction, so it's not SU2 invariant. But if I look at the relative angle between two spins, then this object, if I do a global rotation, this object is going to be invariant. Okay? So it means that the relative angle between two spins is an observable quantity. I mean, so that was a physical argument. And now you can define this relative angle just by taking the scalar product of your system with respect to another spin, which would be my reference spin. And you can check that indeed this quantity does commute with a constraint. Okay? And now what I can do is I can introduce two other spins, for example, and I can look at my coordinates of my system into my reference frame. Okay? And these quantities are observables. All right. So there is also an example, maybe a third example very quickly, given by Carlo, which is that if I have a diffeomorphism in symmetry, so this is my plane, I'm just considering a 2D Minkowski space-time, a point, if I have a diffeomorphism symmetry, has low meaning. Okay? If I want to have to identify a point, it means that I need to have some following Einstein, I need to have some incidence particles. So, for example, I could have some rays of light that meet at this point. Okay? And so now I can define coordinates of this P if I introduce, for example, two satellites that are emitting. So I consider two satellites here. So here they have a speed U2. This one has V1 mu, okay? They go like that, and they emit a ray of light, and then here I have a point P. And so I can, if I have diffeomorphic symmetry, it's a physical meaning, it has physical meaning to define the coordinate of P with respect to this reference frame made of the satellites, okay? And so now you can calculate the coordinate in this reference frame, and so Carlo gave this definition here. So the satellites here define you a natural reference frame. So this is a way to construct really coordinates, physical coordinates, even though you have diffeomorphic symmetry. All right, so then what we do in gravity, I mean quantum gravity, is that we have this constraint, and we want to quantize that. So in quantum gravity, it was pretty difficult. It's not completely done, of course. And so we just construct from the phase space, the kinematical Hilbert space. We quantize the constraints. We are careful, of course, there are many issues. You have to be careful of ordering ambiguities. You need to check that your constraints are of a polynomial form, and so on. And then the kernel, the kernel of the constraints, provide you the physical Hilbert space. And again, the observables are quantities, are operators that commute with the quantum constraints. Okay. So
the computation they use freedom.
Yeah. So that's what is done in loop quantum gravity, right? So, but in general, when I have a constraint system, that would be that's the standard procedure. So a priori, we can also construct quantum observables or quantum relational observable and producing a quantum reference frame. But I think in the quantum gravity case, this is not very well understood yet. Maybe Bianca should. We cannot. I think Bianca is expert here. So. But I come back to my simple example. Of course, I have spins, finite dimensional system. Things are pretty cool, pretty simple. I can quantize straightforwardly. And so now I have my quantum, I'm dealing with quantum spins. I have my constraints, which is just given by those operators, so it's a quantum spin. Now the total spin is still zero, obviously. And then I can define quantum relational observables. Okay, so basically, I have this guy here, it's a quantum spin. This is a quantum reference frame, and I'm projecting my system along this quantum reference frame, and this is an observable quantity. Okay, so I have introduced here a quantum reference frame, and so, like I said before, that would be the way, that I think that should be also the way to construct observables in quantum gravity, but then to understand this structure, we need then to understand the physics of having a quantum reference frame, okay? And so we can ask a number of questions. For example, if I yeah.
What you mean by a quantum reference frame, going back to your thing with the frame being proximal is being used to measure it,
yeah.
Is that now the frame field is an operator that lives in the Hilbert
yes.
space of both the
yes.
gravity and the matter system?
That would be that, yes.
Yes.
So, and so then, but then so in Gray's case, it's much more involved. I mean, here there was trivial to construct really the observable. But in the gravity case, you need to project on, I mean, the physical interspace.
Yes, sure. But conceptually, what you mean by quantum reference frame is just a reference frame described in quantum mechanics. It's not
yes, yes. So basically, I would take quantum fields. I would take some quantum fields and look at some other quantum degrees of freedom with respect to this quantum field such that the relation, the combination of those degrees of freedom is an observable quantity. So that commutes with the improvised constraints, homomorphism. All right. So, like I was saying, we have a number of questions. If my reference frame is quantum, means that it's like a fuzzy, then how much can it be precise? Okay, if it gets fuzzy, maybe I cannot be arbitrarily precise. If it's quantum also, maybe there are some quantum effects that can make it kick around. Okay, there can be some weird effects so that, so I think it's a valid question to ask how robust it is. And then if I have a quantum reference frame, do I get those non-commutative coordinates? So people doing quantum gravity are aware that there is loop quantum gravity on one side, and then Korn is on the other side is saying the fundamental structure of space-time should be non-commutative. But how do you relate the two? How do you get non-commutative coordinates in this regime? So maybe it's the fact that we have a quantum reference frame is a way to get non-commutative coordinates. Then if we have a quantum reference frame, what is the notion of symmetry associated to that? And then I constructed relational observables. And now if I take mini particles, how do we put them together? How do we put relational degrees of freedom together? And so that's those a number of questions, and that's nicely these questions are, of course, of interest for quantum gravity, but also for quantum information people. So that there is a nice interplay there where we can talk to this different community. Clearly, they're going to deal with simpler models than in quantum gravity. So for us, their fundamental model is going to be a toy model for us. But I mean, at least we can discuss. Actually, I was in Australia last week, and people, I was visiting some quantum information group there, and they were pretty excited about that, this relation. So, quantum gravity, we need a quantum reference frame to construct observables. Let's study the physics of a quantum reference frame. So I'm going to pick up this spin system, Todd Moidel, that actually took from these guys from quantum information theory. So this my reference frame is defined by two quantum spin. Okay, so they have a spin L. They have, since they are spins, they satisfy some non-trivial commutations of non-trivial brackets. And then, so I picked up two axes. So I have my two axes, and my third axis, I can pick it up as being the vector product between my two first axes. Okay, and so. So I
J1
and J2, so they're defined two axes, and then on my third, I can define it as to be the vector for the two. I could have introduced also three particles, okay, this legend. And so now I can define my relational coordinates, and so I have S1 projection on this guy, S2 projection of this guy, and S3 is a projection of J3, okay? So I have S1, S2, S3, I can look at the commutation relation I've got. So S1 with S2 is just a standard S2, so it's fine. But then if I take S2 with S3, I get non-trivial terms. So here there are those terms that rise, and that's because I picked up general, two axes which are not orthogonal. If they start to be orthogonal, then I have got only this extra term that arise, S1, S2, okay? And the similar things for here. So it means that here I have a modification. I don't get the S2 usual transformation. Okay, I get extra terms. Yes.
So there are two systems, J1 and J2, let's spin out. Then you have some other system.
Yes.
Okay, and you're using J1 and J2 to define the measurements on the other system.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I define the coordinates of my system in terms of J1 and J2.
Okay. And so in these other non-commutative terms that you get, they're like, to the fact that these systems are not.
So part
of the physical reason why you get this extra.
Yes, all right. So part of it here is due to the fact that the axes are not orthogonal. Okay, so you can get rid of that. And the fact here, there is some extra term that arises that due to the fact that this reference frame is not as a non-commutative structure.
So that's quantum, like the last.
It's quantum, yeah.
Pure quantum contribution.
Yes, So it means that here I have a modification of the SU2 transformation. Okay, so it's not, the coordinates are not SU2. And so it means that here, when I do measurements, I get a modification of the outcome of measurements. So I'm not going to get the standard outcome of measuring S2 and S3. So in this sense, really, the outcome of measurements is going to be, for me, I see it as the way to say that non-commutativity here is appearing. So if I use the quantum reference frame, I can kind of generate some kind of non-commutativity. So if I want to look at a bigger reference frame, so it means that I'm going to consider my axis 1 in the current state in X, my axis 2 in the current state Y, okay? So they are in current states. And I can look at, I can trace out and look at what are the semi-classical coordinates in this very big reference frame, okay? And doing the analysis, so that's what we obtain. And we see that when L is very big, so when L, my reference frame, gets very, very big, I just recover the standard SU2 transformation. Okay, so it means that, so when the reference frame becomes classical, I recover the standard spin, which is something that we could expect, right? The standard spin structure. And just for that you remember, here in this case, my system is just described in terms of those projectors. So I have two J plus one projectors that define my system psi. Okay? So in the semi-classical case, I just recover the usual SU2 algebra. So let's talk about measurements. So I want to measure my relational observable. This relational observable is a tensor product of two representations of SU2, J and L. So if it's a tensor product representation, I can decompose it into a sum of a direct sum of representation, okay? And I can decompose my relational observable here, my coordinate in terms of physical projectors here. So those projectors project down in the with the square of associated to the representation K. Okay, so K is a Casimir of a representation, so it's a naturally SU2 invariant. Okay, so I decompose my observable in terms of projectors or physical projectors. All right? So just standard SU2 analysis, my projectors are nonlinear functions of my relational coordinates. Okay? And now, I just apply the standard von Neumann ID, which is that I will obtain the outcome lambda, the eigenvalue lambda, with probability given just by acting, by projecting on the state K, this state, which is rho. So the rho is for the reference frame and sigma for the system. I can really look at this guy and really just talk, reinterpret this guy here just in terms of the system here. So you see that due to the fact that I have introduced a reference frame, I'm looking at the relational coordinate, means that the quantum reference frame is kind of inducing some fuzziness on my measure on the reference. It's introducing some fuzziness on the measure of my system's psi, which is in the state sigma. Okay, so I can rewrite that this quantity here, so I can trace just on the reference frame. Okay. And I get, so what in quantum information, that they get a POVM, a projector operator valued measurement. Huh?
Positive.
So, which means that it's not, this guy here is not really a projector, and something that's basically it's a fuzzy projector. So what I obtain is that on my system psi, I obtain an approximation of a measurement. Okay, so you can expand this guy, my POVM, in terms of the projector just on my system psi. Okay, and so I have some terms here that depends on the state of my reference frame. So I get just an approximation of the measurement that is usually done on sigma. Okay, so that's an approximation. So it means that in this way, I can encode, for example, if I want these guys to be very small, I can play with the state rho, and so I can discuss how much precise would be my reference frame by trying to minimize these quantities here. And if I take my reference frame very, very big, then these quantities are going to tend to zero. I'm just going to recover the usual projectors. Okay. So a quantum reference frame here. This is a way to encode the precision of a quantum reference frame. So this was on the system. Then I can also talk about the reference frame itself. And so for that, you notice that if I look at the commutator between the relational coordinate and my reference frame here, this is non-zero. So it means that if I measure my relational coordinates, then I'm going to get a kickback, like you said, I'm going to get a kickback on my reference frame. All right? So you start to see now where I'm going, because so precisely that was the thing I was looking for. So now what we can do is that we can implement some measurements. So I measure my system. Okay, so it means that the new state is the new state is this one. So I projected my state in the K subspace. So I do a measurement, I project down, okay, and then I have the choice how I can do the next measurement. I can either remember that I've well, the outcome of my measurement, so I just can forget. So if I forget, it means that my new state is going to be given by a sum over all the possible outcomes, and then I will project again. Okay, I project again. So basically, this is the feature I chosen here. I projected my state after our measurements, and then I forget about the outcome. So it means that I take my new state to be of my reference frame to be the sum over the all possible outcomes. Okay, so clearly, since this guy, since here you see that I'm doing a trace, and this guy, the projector, entangles the system with a reference frame, I'm going to get some. Since I'm doing a trace and entangling the guys here, a partial trace, sorry, then it means that I'm going to get a non-unitary evolution. Okay, I have some decoherence appearing. So really, the dynamic is non-unitary. And so David Poulin and Yon Yard, both at Caltech, basically looked at this evolution here that is implemented here. Okay, so they do consecutive measurements on the reference frame, and they look how the reference frame behaves. So I have this kickback on my reference frame induced by the measurement, and then they looked at the dynamic of the reference frame.
Is due to degrees of freedom that you don't take into account. So the theory of chronographers should be unitary, but the back reaction of the measuring apparatus.
Yes. So it depends. So here, it's no. The key point is that when you project, when you look at the physical degrees of freedom, you have to entangle the system with the reference frame.
Yeah.
And then, if you want to look at what happens to the reference frame, you need to trace out the system. But since it has been entangled with the reference frame, that means that the reference frame has lost some degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but in principle, the full theory should be unitary.
Oh, really, the full thing
is unitary. That's what I said. So it's an effective degree.
Yes. And so David looked at it, and what he saw is that basically what the main effect that appears at first order is a rotation. So the kickback is a rotation. And so if we have the system there and the reference frame here, basically, by doing a measurement, the reference frame is going to rotate towards the system. Okay, so if you have a free axis and doing measurements on each of them, then grosso modo, you can say that the reference frame is going to rotate towards the system. Okay, so that's a kickback. So clearly, there is decoherence. So it means it's a non-unitary evolution. Okay, but at first order, the dominant part is this rotation. So it means that I can neglect the noise, the non-unitary part. Okay, so I really have some invertible transformation. Okay, the rotation being a unitary transformation is invertible. So this he described at least the evolution in terms of the state of the reference frame, and we can clearly move to the Heisenberg picture, and then so we look at the evolution of the reference frame. Okay. And so now we have a reference frame that undergoes a kickback induced by the system, okay, induced by the measurement. And so it's the system kickbacking on the reference frame. Okay. I should say that so the noise is negligible when the number of measurements is smaller than the speed. Okay. So of course, then if it's not the case, then you're going to have a lot of noise. And so you're going to lose the invertibility of the transformation. Okay. So the fact that the measurement the fact that there exists a regime where the kickback is really invertible is a bit similar to the case in quantum field theory, where you know when you do randomization group, you basically integrate out some degrees of freedom. But so if you integrate out some degrees of freedom, it means that the leftover shouldn't behave in a unitary way, right? Because a priori the higher degrees of freedom are coupled to the lower degrees of freedom. But since they are very weakly coupled to the lower degrees of freedom, it means that grosso modo what you're left with is still unitary. Okay? So that's a similar thing that is happening here. And so the main point is then that now I have a kickback of my system on the reference frame, which means that my reference frame becomes dependent on my system. So now this is what I was looking from the DSR perspective, right? So this reference frame that depends on the system. So now if I pick up a reference frame, I have another one which is related to this one by rotation. It's left hand, so I cannot do it. So there is a rotation relating to two. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do measurements. So this guy is going to evolve. I mean, there's going to be this kickback. And now I can ask a question. What would have been the outcome of the same similar say of measurements on this guy? What I'm going to do is I'm going to undo all my measurements, provided that I can invert. Okay, so I have to be in this specific regime where I can neglect the noise. So I'm going to undo the measurements, do my rotation, and do the form back. Okay, so that's exactly the same picture we had for this DSR case. All right, so it's pretty cool. We have this kind of deformation of the symmetry. And here, like I was saying, we have this kickback. So it means that the reference frame is evolving in a weird way. And so quantum information people, for example, would be very interested to quantify how robust is the reference frame and how precise is the reference frame. And if you put, in general, if you put most robust and most precise, then the two things are not consistent. So you need to have a trade-off between the two. If it's very precise, then it's going to be easy to, it's not going to be robust in general. All right. So now let's go to the multiparticle case. Can I say something about that? So you remember that in this our case, we have this non-commutative addition, which was a bit weird. So what would be the picture when we have a reference frame? So we consider the sum of the momenta, pi 1 and pi 2. So that's the intrinsic momenta of the two particle system. And clearly, now if I want to have the coordinates of this sum of momenta, I just project down on the reference frame. Okay, so that's the standard special relativity case. So that's the standard addition. Now, if the frame is deformed, then you take this guy and you have a dependence here. But then what does it mean? I mean, it means that you need a specific shape of this effective reference frame to really say something to be equal to explicit this expression here. So you really need to do some thinking, and a priori it's not easy, like you asked. So what happens in my little toy model? I pick up two, yes? So gamma?
You snuck that through about the Sacrobar problem.
So gamma here, just put it by hand. I mean, there is no clear motivation. I mean, at this stage, the two particle system, I would say that it really depends on your model, how you define this guy. Okay, so in the, I cannot see much more. I need to pick up a model and analyze it. And here, so I wanted to be sure that there is no problem with this expression, so I introduced by hand our scaling of the time scale.
It's just some big number.
Yeah, I mean, which would be proportional to the number of particles.
Right, so you're taking on board that older idea of yours,
that would be my classic, but this, I just put that by hand, I repeat. This guy is no motivation.
It neither comes out of nor is required by the argument you're making about quantum reference frames.
Yes, a priori not.
Okay.
So should I interpret, for example, the labeling of the particles as one, the first particle I measure, and two, the second one I measure with the frame, something like this?
Well, so in the special relativity case.
No, in the special relativity case there is nothing. But in the non-commutative.
Oh, here I don't know. I didn't write this expression in terms of the reference frame. This hasn't been done. Okay.
But yeah. Shouldn't this MP comes from the same idea as Professor Lang spoke? Eventually, you cannot. You know, eventually you will create a black hole if you make the apparatus too big. So this should be somehow related to the Planck scale.
So the gamma is because you want a restraining black. You remember I was talking about the Sacrobar problem that if you add particles, you need to, that your maximum scale depends.
I agree, but you didn't discuss anything about the possibility of forming a black hole if you make your measuring apparatus too big.
Yes, but how the scaling would. I think we should talk about that. So, as I said before, sorry about. I just put it there by hand. I didn't expect that it would go on this measure.
But in any case, in a measurement approach, you can say that without asking just for the skeleton of a plant, that is very specific. You can still say that it's not so incredible that somehow the number of particles involved in the measurement can affect the answer in this frame.
Yeah.
So. I don't know if you, I mean, sticking to the scaling of Planck is not just, it's already a specific perspective. The total, the capital E, the effective frame can be dependent on the number of particles.
Yes.
It is not so, a priori.
But it depends on your model. I mean, we need to redo the model and check it out.
A priori, there isn't any reason why it shouldn't.
A priori, yes. I mean, since a priori this measurement is really a physical approach, then clearly you must solve this Sacrobar problem. So, in a way or another. I mean, I think it's model dependent. And so, since it's model, I think it's, so you need to look at how you do that in a specific model. I pick up my little model and check it out. Okay, so I took two spins. So I do the sum of those two spins. Those quantities obviously commute with each other. and the total spin, those two spin and cross spin commute with each of them. All right. So now I look at the total spin projected. Sorry. So I consider two spins, two systems. No, but that's, they commute with each other. One, the spin one commutes with spin two.
Yes, but how can the total commute all the components? The total is a vector two.
No, oh yeah, no, no, sorry, that's a mistake. Yeah, sorry about that.
Square.
Yeah, yeah, sorry about that.
The square.
That's, no, okay, so this formula is wrong. Sorry about that. Yeah. Okay, but it's not really important. What really does matter is that I construct the total spin, I mean, I project down the total spin on my reference frame. And then I can look at how, I can expand this guy in just S1 plus S2, and I can look at how, if I measure S1 and then I measure S2, what do I get? Okay? And so calculating the commutator of S1 and S2 basically is non-zero. So it means that if I measure S1 and then S2, this is non-commutative. Okay? So I think that this is a way to encode, a physical way at least for me, to encode how some non-commutativity can appear in the game. So it's a way to encode, to explain this non-commutativity that appears in the sum of momentum. All right? And so I can also calculate the one component, so one subsystem, the physical one subsystem with the total system, and clearly this is also not zero. So it means that measuring the subsystems and adding the result is not the same as measuring the full system. Okay, so this is physically the kind of ID we would like to see or to interpret this non-commutative sum in this DSR case. Is there an analog of the soccer ball problem? So you remember that my projectors, my physical projectors, basically were defined in terms of K, which was the representation arising from the tensor product of L and J. And I have two L plus one projectors. Okay, my system is defined on the other hand, my system is defined in terms of two J plus one projectors. So it means that if I have J, which is smaller than L, then a priori it seems that I have enough projectors in my reference frame to basically have a full information on my system here. Okay? So it seems good. But then if I have J, which is bigger than, my system, which is bigger than my reference frame, then my reference frame can provide me only a limited information on J. Okay, so I cannot specify completely my system. So it shows that in some sense, L is the maximum quantity of, this is encoding the maximum information I can access on my system. So in a sense, L would be,
Decoupling theorem
that you
were mentioning earlier?
No.
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 So how does this
relate
to the decoupling theorem?
The decoupling theorem was on when I was looking at the decoupling theorem was on the dynamics of my reference frame. And the dynamics was non-unitary. Right. So it means that you can decompose this dynamic into something that is invertible. Okay, unitary, and something that is not, some noise. And in the decoupling approach, basically you say that the noise in general is negligible, so you only care about the unitary part. So that's why I was just looking in my, because you remember that when I was defining the deformation, I had to have an invertible map. It's essential to have an invertible map, so it means that I can invert it. I cannot invert noise. When I have noise, it's losing.
That's right.
I lose information, so I cannot invert.
But any measurement you look at, you cannot invert. Is that part of the sense of quantum mechanics?
Yes, that's true. But here, I had some. So here, what I was looking at is the dynamics of my system. Yes. I was looking at how my system behaves, and I was saying that when my system behaves partly in a unitary part and partly in a non-unitary part. Okay, let me finish and then we can go. So I would say that here L is basically the analog of my Planck scale. It gives me a maximum amount of information I can access. And is there really a soccer ball problem? Well, I think in this case, not really, because if I want to have the full information, of my system, I just can pick up another bigger reference frame and so access a priori all the information of my system. Okay, so that is not really a, I mean, that is something a bit similar, but not really to the soccer ball problem. I mean, here by taking a bigger L prime, it's like for scaling the Planck scale. Okay, so that would be the idea that we would like to encode in the DSR case. So conclusions. So the main idea that I would like you to have is that in quantum gravity, we need to have quantum reference frames to construct observables, and that's because quantum gravity is a quantum constraint system. And then what I did is that I looked at the physical situation when I have a quantum reference frame, and we saw that there were some funny features appearing, like non-commutativity, symmetry deformation, some weird coarse-graining appearing. That is, if I measure first the subsystem, it's not the same as adding the outcome of measurements of subsystem to get the outcome of if I was measuring the full system. And then these kind of features are appearing also in the context of DSR. So I'm not going to say I proved that the DSR is the physical, is the flat symmetric classical limit, but I think it's a good argument in favor of DSR as the right semi classical limit. Okay, so it's just a toy model, so I cannot say much more than that. I would like to add also that this kind of things is also of interest of a different community. And so there is a nice interplay with people. So I was talking with quantum information people last week, and I was pretty interested in that. So we can bring some of their ideas into the game, and for some of our idea in quantum gravity to their game. So that could be a pretty nice interplay. And of course, this was a toy model, so it was dealing just spins, I mean, finite dimensional model. So we need to make the things a bit more complicated. I mean, we aim at quantum gravity, and so the key point, I think, my aim would be to construct a quantum reference frame using quantum fields, and this is basically like a generalization of this paper of Giddings, Maroff, and Hartl, where they took a reference frame made of semi-classical state of a field. Okay, so they took right away a semi-classical state. It would be interesting to see how their construction is generalized what gives their construction when we are really using quantum fields. All right, thank you.
I'm confused about the story having some reference to quantum measurement and reference frame. So, I mean, your claim is not that if I have a cosmic ray proton or a photon coming from a long way away, that I'll have a different dispersion relation if I keep measuring it. I think that's not your claim. Your claim is
you have to measure it with respect to another quantum quantity.
Yeah. No. But
if you measure the spin of a photon with respect to another quantum speed, then.
I think that measurement is a misnomer. Let me tell you what I think is happening in your mathematics, and tell me if you disagree. Okay. What I think is happening is that you're saying, and I'm going to make reference to the case we're really interested in. Okay? If we look at the Hamiltonian of the Dirac, you know, proton or electron traveling, or the photon. The Hamiltonian has the frame field of space-time in it.
Yes.
Okay. If we believe in quantum gravity, then that's an operator.
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, it's not the point that it's, quote, a reference frame. It's the point that the frame fields there, are operators which are acting in the Hilbert space of the gravitational field. Okay. If the analog would be, and something like this has been done in different papers, to say, okay, let's now take a semi-classical state in space-time, okay, and let's consider the effect of those quantum effects from the semi-classical state of space-time on the propagation of the particle.
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll see that there are effects like additions, like momentum is no longer additive, or quote, the metric. If I insist on thinking about the metric classically, it will appear to be energy dependent, but it's dependent on the energy of the particle that's propagating and so forth. But there's no measurement going on. So
So, am I understanding correctly? It's just that the thing that gives.
So that's okay. So here I so this is a toy model, and I chose non-entangling system. So I think that in the gravity case, you should have, for example, a kickback, a gravitational kickback for the particle on.
It's not the classical kickback. It's the fact that in the expression for the Hamiltonian of the particle, that is the Dirac, you know, proton or electron, there is the operator E representing the Frank field.
Yes.
And it's the quantum mechanics of that operator which are affecting the dispersion relations of the particle and the addition of momentum in Planck space and so forth.
Yes.
But its dependence on the state of the particle has to come through after measurement. As an operator, it does not depend on the state of the particle, or does it?
I don't think that it's not that it comes from measurement, i.e. from von Neumann's second rule from collapse of the wave function. It comes from tracing over the semi-classical state that just as you did,
yeah,
and inducing,
yeah,
an in principle non-unitary,
yes,
action on the remaining degrees of freedom,
yes,
for the same reason. But it's not that we're, it's not that we, you deform the dispersion relations by making measurements on them.
Oh, you're saying that you avoid what is projection.
So you're just referring to language, it's an interaction with the environment.
It's just, yeah, yes, and the environment is the quantum.
Is the quantum phone,
yes,
or whatever.
I could agree with that. But so, that's what you say. See, you have an interaction with an environment. Here, I have no interaction. So I had to produce this entanglement. I mean, I had to produce this non-unitary version. So I used a measurement to generate this kind of interaction.
Right, but if your, the analogy would be if you had a Hamiltonian, if you're interacting with a spin system.
Yeah.
Which use the angular momentum as measured,
yeah,
by the frame.
Okay.
In the same sense that the Dirac Hamiltonian,
yes, yes,
okay,
yes,
has,
yes,
the momentum in Fock space but as measured in the frame determined,
yes,
by the gravitational field.
Yes. That would be the analogy, yes. So yeah. But that's so yeah, so I figured out the summarize. I just here I took non entangling stuff. So I mean, I had to mix. I mean, I had to mix, find a way to mix my reference frame with my system. And so, since it was not interacting, I had to generate to find a trick to mix them. And this was equivalent to my measurement, the project now. If you have interacting stuff, I mean, then so you can rewrite exactly what you say, the spin system, in terms of the evolution of the speed, then I would get some kind of interaction with some idea on that. Yes.
Yeah, thanks for this very interesting talk, but I feel like I just have to ask that question. What is the phenomenology? I mean, soccer balls do exist, that can't be it. So
no, it does not exist, that's what I said. I said there is no soccer ball problem in my spin system. So what did I wanted to look at? I just wanted to look at the physics of a simple, in a toy model, of having, so I constructed in a toy model a quantum constraint, and try to see if I can have some features that also appear in the context of DSR. Okay? And what are the features that appeared? I think that what was interesting is that I get some kind of non-commutativity, some non-trivial commutation relation between the coordinates. If you're in my model, I don't have space-time. I mean, it's a toy model. So we need to extend this construction to field and so on, where then we can look, talk about momentum, position, and so on. But in my toy model, I have a field, a dead, with a quantum constraint, I had some kind of non-commutativity that appears. I saw that measure, if I consider two systems, it's not the same to measure the subsystem. I mean, sorry, if I consider a big system made of two particles, it's not the same to measure one system and the second one in an add component. So I get some non-commutativity, which I think it's a way to, I find it interesting because it's a way to interpret this DSR non-commutativity. So non-commutativity,
well, maybe I can just...
And the symmetric deformation, of course.
Maybe I can just find a question. So given these studies that you've made, what are your thoughts on the predictions that have been made from the DSR models, like, for the case of the DCK curve? You know,
occasion,
time,
Okay, so the question I tried to address in this talk was to try to find a justification of and a physical interpretation of DSR. Okay, so personally, I trust that DSR should be the right semi-classical limit, and I try to give a physical meaning to that using a toy model. Okay, then now I cannot say if it's going to change a lot of things from the GZK picture or so on. Now, this is just a toy model, a very simple one. I need to try to extend this construction to the to Poincaré symmetries. Here it was just a to-do, so I need to extend that to Poincaré symmetries with this physical interpretation, and then revisit those questions that you mentioned.
That actually might change.
Sorry? No, I don't know. Well, it's a gap. I would say no.
So I think it's very interesting that starting from this quantum reference frame, you end up having the formation of commutators plus this non-abelian composition of generators, which is basically what you're doing is just showing that using quantum reference frames, you end up using quantum deformations of the algebra.
Because the form
commutators plus. So one thing is
it's not SU2 compute.
That's my question. So is that SU2 or
no, I don't think
something
so.
That could be related to like
I don't think so.
Okay, and then the other thing is about this.
Oh, but the thing is that you get this so
careful already, yeah. So what
so much the mathematical if you ask a mathematical question, if is it SU2Q, I don't think so. But then there's the geometry described by the set of these peaks, they are related to a free sphere. So there's some kind of fuzzy not committed to the.
Yes, and just one comment about the solvable problem. So, the form co product, I mean, the off-factor structure of these guys. It's just what was built in originally just to describe like the representation theory of these algebras, okay?
Yep.
So I guess when you're talking about these deformed co-products, you're just talking about tensor products of one particle space, okay?
Yep.
So a soft ball is not one particle, it's not described by a Hilbert space or anything
else. Yep.
So I guess in order to properly address the soft ball problem, you should just go ahead and first of all build your nice quantum field theory with your Fox phase interaction and so on, and then go.
You're taking a choice there with your J on reference frames.
Yep.
The two possibilities are either that we picked the only viable frame that would work in this particular situation, or that...
Well,
the question is, besides what the limitation you put on there, is there any reason to think there might be other limitations on the actual commutation relations? In terms of what's defining the commutation relation, because we just used J total, but if we went into this not using that in particular, would we have any either a priori or just heuristic reasons for putting those particular commutation relations in there, or relate to the spins that were already there?
So I don't really understand the second part, but let me try to answer at least answer the first part. So even in the classical case, when you construct some rational observers, it's not always possible that your crop protocol is going to be valid over all space-time. Sometimes at some point, the crop seems to be good. And just in this case, for example, my reference frame, if I do many measurements, as I told you, it's slowly collapsing towards the direction of my system, all my axes. So at some point, my reference frame is going to last. Mm-hmm. So it means that I need to get rid of it and take another one.
Right, but it's that amount that it goes bad, is what, in terms of the actual, the amount by which they don't compute, is what I'm wondering, if there's any limits or if there's any rationale behind, if we were to just use something.
I think it's just that you want to pick up a good reference frame, and so you can, I guess you have different ways to define good, but it's up to you, you choose it. a priori there is no rationale, as you said, but general principle is going to tell you one should be better than another one. You should look at the different preference frame that you can have and check out that there are good enough for what you're concerned and for what you want to do.
Okay. We're going to have one last question, and I'm sure for Anthony to be available during lunch for more people to ask.
So far, the reference frame things and the strings you are considering, do they interact?
No, they are not.
So I think you would get more interesting facts if you would interact.
Right. And there would just be more complication.
Yeah. it's how reality is that the reference system today.
And like Neil was saying, maybe you don't need to input these projection measurements to implement the fact, right? Yeah, I think that would be you can help formulate theory so that there's these nice features in the game.
Okay, so thank our speaker again.